Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 175 with the title Brave Learning, Bold Leadership. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Pippa O'Brien. Pippa is a learning innovator and founder of Proda, transforming how frontline teams experience inclusion through immersive drama and authentic conversations. And when I asked Pippa to describe her superpower, she said, it's just turning everyday people into empowered learners through real-world storytelling. Hello, Pippa. Welcome to the show.
Joe, thank you so much for inviting me. I feel really privileged and honoured to be the guest on episode 175. I'm in very safe hands, clearly. And looking at your nails, I think beautifully manicured safe hands as well.
Manicured
mine are under
safe
the
hands.
Table for a reason. Not so manicured, right? Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. We met probably 18 months ago.
Yeah. Must be,
just to work with Talis, wasn't it?
We did a storytelling.
Yeah. I was
we did
one of your protagonists in a story, wasn't I?
Yes, definitely. And then we took that input and we used it for some drama where we showcased what allyship should and could look like and involved the learners in feeding lines to the actors so they could be really fully immersed and involved in the story as well.
Yeah. And it was all around transgender inclusion, if I remember rightly, and my wife Marie was involved, and we did a kind of a dual perspective on workplace and how she felt and how I felt, which was quite powerful, wasn't it?
It was really powerful. And I think one of the lessons that that organisation took from that session was, yes, it could be transgender. It could be any other situation that somebody is facing in their life, and that there's no playbook out there that covers every possible scenario that could be going on in somebody's life. And actually, the using your and Marie's story, if you like, to set the scene was so powerful and really thought-provoking. And then in the drama, we flipped it and we had the actor from memory. The scenario that I'd written was a gay couple where one of the members of the one partner in that partnership wanted to transition. That was the way that we flipped it. And actually, you never know what's going on for people. People show up for work. They do the best that they can in the moment. And what's under the surface is like this massive iceberg that you just don't see, but it comes out through people's behavior. It's what they say and what they do that gives clues to what's going on under the surface. And quite often that's the time when somebody needs to reach out and say, what's happening? Tell me. And but doing so from a position where there's trust between the two people, and the leadership behavior then is really around not just trust, but the integrity piece as well. Like, I need you to trust me and I'm going to trust you, but actually I need you to treat that information with integrity and be there to support me as a person. Really, that's kind of the message that I wanted to come out from that session.
Because we hear that lived experience, talking and stories are really, really powerful, and they are.
Yeah.
But in my experience, the learning doesn't always occur. I don't go and watch a Netflix or go to the cinema and hear these powerful stories, whether they're real drama or interpreted, and always take learning away from them. So what we're going to try and do is take a two-dimensional story and create rumination, creating firing points in our brains. And that's where the experiential, the storytelling with interaction kicks in, isn't it?
Totally. And that's really what we've done with a program that we've been running quite recently. And this is something that was really a little bit of a, well, I'm going to suggest this. This is a bit out there, if you know what I mean. And I was really expecting the client to come back and go, oh, no, that's, well, we couldn't do that. And actually they didn't. They went, okay, let's do it. And I was, okay. So a bit surprised, but also really honoured that they had trusted me to do a great job for them. And not just me, but my whole team, the whole team here at PODA. And their population and workforce, although there's a number of them who are really highly qualified professionals, the bulk of their workforce is people who are really skilled, but they're manual workers. So they do manual work outside in all weathers, that's pretty unpleasant at times, I'll be honest. The average reading age for a lot of these operatives is 11, age 11. So when I was designing something, I had to be really mindful that for whatever reason, they had this lower literacy level, but that could be caused by a number of different reasons. But for whatever reason, school had failed them in some way or another, or education had failed them. So putting them in a classroom environment with them, and here's slide 199, which just describes the Equality Act of 2010, probably wasn't going to be the real way forward for this audience. So what we designed was a program where from the moment they arrived, they were immersed into a real life drama, if you want to call it that. And we had the characters in the drama welcoming them. Oh dear, my words got a little bit mumbled up there. Inviting them and welcoming them to the session. And then allowing them to observe a meeting where there was some extremes of opinion being expressed. Okay, and what we asked them to do was just listen and then talk about it afterwards. Okay, so what did they notice? What behaviors did they notice? What words did they hear? And what did that mean for them? So how did that resonate with them and their own personal experiences? So the lived experiences then came from within the room as much as anything. And we really wanted people who were maybe of a generation, I think like Gen Z, I think is one way to describe them, to talk about how people have made assumptions about them and what they were capable of based on their age. We wanted people to talk about gender. We wanted to talk about people who had and really explore a whole range of labels, really, which that people give other people that are really about bias, aren't they? You know, there's nothing else to describe it. Oh, there are this, there are that. That's a label. And actually the label is the bias, and it can be positive or not so positive, but equally there's something here around challenging those biases and really reminding people that actually as individuals and as human beings, we're always looking to confirm biases unless we actively are challenged on them. So the data that sticks is the data that confirms the biases that we already hold and the opinions that we already hold. So, and that's kind of linked to also, I mean, then with these people, we were talking about, well, why is that then? And they were talking about, well, it's social media, isn't it? You know, we had some great discussions around social media, the role of the press, and then moving into allyship and how to challenge up. And we used our drama team to role play like a more senior member of staff, and then how they could challenge that in a way that was going to be non-threatening for them individually. And we had some great outcomes from that, really great, some really great conversations. You've got some people that go, no, he's right, he's wrong, and that was it. But everybody else in the room was saying, you don't think that, do you? Well, yes, I do. And that's great, because you're bringing it all out into the open in one go. The only way we could do that was to create a really safe environment where people felt they could genuinely say what they believe and to be prepared to be challenged by other people in a way that was appropriate. Okay. We're really pleased with that one. It landed well. And you can see from my face that we actually really enjoy doing it as well. It's like, and I'm doing it this week for a company down in Winchester. So I'm quite excited about that. It's one that I love doing.
Yeah, I found, you know, I've run a lot of training sessions on inclusive recruitment and inclusive best practice or whatever it may be. And sometimes you walk into the room and you can see people with their arms folded. Yeah, the I don't want to be here. This is all a bunch of woke nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's always what you, and they have that face on, don't they? And then you do the introductions in the room.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you hoping to get out of today? And this person's always kind of making some sort of remark about whatever, because I have to be, whatever. But I find that those people do two things. One is they enlighten the rest of the room as to the importance of why we're here today. Because they're doing my job there. They're sort of saying, well, I haven't got to say, is there anti-pushback on this? There's already that person's in the room. But the second thing that happens is this person becomes enlightened. And their change in them is far greater than the change in people who actually get it. So I always come at the end of it. I've had these people come out to me, or at the end of it, I say, so what have we got out of it? Oh, I've seen a new perspective. And I never really thought about this. And it's like, you think, wow. I've made a measurable difference in this one person. Absolutely. My job is done.
Yeah.
Everybody else got it already. All I've done is nudge them a bit. This person here went from being uninformed to being embracing it. You think, wow, how powerful is that? And I think that's what frustrates me sometimes when we have these conversations and we always end up with the echo chamber in the room, not the people who should be in the room but who aren't. Do you find it's easier to get people in the room when you're doing the storytelling and this role-playing than it would be through traditional training?
100%. And that's regardless of the organisational level, if you like. It's just as powerful at exec level. For example, if we were looking at a DEI programme, then we would start at the top, obviously, and really explore, well, why? Why is this so important? But with that team. And then obviously bring in some data at that point, but also more importantly, do something around allyship, because that's their role. That's what they should be doing every single day, is being the ally for people in their organization and making sure that their organizations reflect the communities and the organizations that they serve as well. And when I see so many people who, I'm going to use example here of back to the office, you know, going back to the office, and you hear so many people at exec level that are saying everybody should work from the office. This is, you know, the people. And actually, when you look at them, there's a certain demographic that says that. And typically, they would be male, white, probably over 50. Now, yes, for them, I'm sure that going to the office is structure, it's routine. And then when they get home, there's somebody who's made sure that their shirts are ready for the next day, that they've got everything that they need to be for them to be successful. If you see what I mean.
On the table, the kids are looked after.
Yeah.
The cat has been fed, everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And when you look at people who during lockdown who were loving it were the people who had that flexibility of being able to do a bit of work, look after their children, be the best person that they could be for their families, do things like the school pickup and the things that they just didn't have a chance to do. And I did a bit of research for a company at the back end of lockdown around whether going back to work was really the way to go, or whether they could actually consider closing down some of their sites and going to a fully remote model, but with some hubs where people could go for meetings, you know, face-to-face meetings if needed. I ran some focus groups for them. And universally, there was a demographic that was like, this is brilliant. I love this. I can get up. I can do 2 hours work. I get the kids packed lunches in the bags. I get them to school. I come back. I do more. And it's for them, it was just what they've always needed and just what they've always needed to be able to be the best person that they can be at work and also the best person that they can be for their family as well. Surely that's what organizations need to ensure is available. Is people to have the flexibility of what works for them, but also make sure that they know how to manage people in a completely different environment. Because I think a lot of people tried to manage people as they always had done from home, and it didn't work. So they've all got to come back to the office. Not what we do needs to change, but or the way that we do this needs to change. But let's just take away all the bits that work for a good percentage of the workforce and impose bits that don't work, you know? So it's like, for me, it's a real fundamental of flexibility is that you trust people to do a great job. You explain the why, and you're the leader that they need in order to be the best that they can be. It's quite simple, in my opinion.
Yeah, when I was doing some events, some roundtable type discussions around the time where we were just about to take our face masks off on trains, you know, sort of that early stage. You remember back in that time, back in that history, and I remember that lots of big companies were trying to sell their culture. We need to get you back in the office because we've got our culture, we've got our way of talking, we've got our way of being. We've got a fantastic culture. We want to. And I took a step back and said, "Well, hang on a minute. What you're trying to do me is exchange culture for commute." It's what you're saying. You give me, I commute for you, and then you give me a culture. And I said, no, hang on a minute. I want my culture like my pension.
Yeah.
It's a personal pension. I can take it anywhere. So when I leave you, I take it with me and go somewhere else. So my personal culture, my family culture, my community culture should be first. And your culture, is this something I borrow while I'm here? I have to like it. I have to fit in with it. I would rather you encourage me to build community links, to co-work in my local community, to have more family time, so that my culture is now my own and we meet because your culture and my culture meet. But don't tell me that I have to have your culture because, yeah, you may have this belief that your culture is amazing, but actually my family is amazing. My friends are amazing. My hobbies, my, and I want that time back. I don't want to give you 2.5 hours of commute each direction because that's my time that I'm giving you for free.
100%. I completely agree with that. And I think that's where having values and actually within an organization can bridge that gap. Because if you make values meaningful in people's daily behavior in an organization, that's one way of bridging the gap between the culture and like personal culture and organizational culture, if you want to call it that, because it's making sure that, for example, if you've got a innovation as a value, which a lot of organizations do, then if somebody asks a great idea, oh, I've got an idea, the hand goes up, and then you get, no, that's not going to work, or really, or no, then I would liken that to that whack-a-mole game, you know, that you get in the fun fair with the hammer and you get the little mole and he sticks his hand up like that. That's my mole impression for the morning. And then the manager's there with the hammer whacking it down. After a while, that mole's going to go, I'm nice and warm and cozy in my hole. I'm not going to get out because if I stick my head up, I'm going to get whacked on the head with a hammer. So that whack-a-mole culture where people say, oh, we believe in innovation. No, they don't. If somebody comes up with an idea, then you need to give it the airtime, explore it. It might not work in that circumstance, but you've got to be really clear with the person why not, rather than just that dismissal piece. Because the one idea that little mole may have in the future that could be the salvation of whatever, that you're never going to hear it because they're never going to tell you. And that's what I mean about living values and bringing values to life.
Yeah, it's not always a bad idea, because if you were to enlighten the person who came up with that thought that didn't work for whatever reason, yeah, as to the reasons why right now it doesn't work, then they go, I get that now, let me have some more thinking.
Correct.
Because one person's thought isn't always one person's thought. A lot of people are often thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at what the government do and think, that's crazy, why are they doing that? I look at what's going on across the water in the States and think, that's crazy, why are they doing that? Maybe there's information I don't know. You know, the media, the military, there's data, there's awareness, there's briefings that politicians have, there's big think tanks going on. And my bias says, I know better because I'm more intelligent, I'm cleverer. That's not a bias I have. We all have that. So we're almost saying, well, that they don't know what they're doing. They must be less intelligent than me. But we've got to accept that they have some good ideas as well. That what I don't know is why they think that. And that's what I need to know. If they tell me, actually, Joe, the reason we're doing this, the reason we're invading that country, and it looks to be a little bit sort of one-sided here, is because there's some threat intelligence that we see that you don't. Okay, now I get it. Yeah. So we don't. If we listen to people's ideas and dismissing them, we need to give them the why, because that if you tell me the why, I can challenge your why with, how about this? And maybe that's what people don't want. They don't want the debate, do they?
They don't want the debate. And I think also there's this I know better than you syndrome as well, which goes back to trust. And I think I know nothing about government, please, but except what I see and hear and read like everybody else. But equally, what I do know is I struggle to trust people that don't do what they say they're going to do. And if you want people to accept what you say because you know facts and information that can't be revealed, whether that's within an organization or nationally or internationally, globally, you have to prove that you are trustworthy. Because why would you trust somebody that says one thing and then does something else? Okay, so it's around building a culture that's based on trust, and then people might not like what you do. They may not fully understand the reasons, but if they trust that you are a leader with integrity, then they will go with it and they'll buy into it.
Because there's nothing worse than being told, there's a reason I can't tell you. It's like, I'm not worthy of
that.
I'm aloof here. I've got stuff you don't know. And so I guess sometimes you can't be told that you don't know something you don't know.
Yeah.
It's trying to sell that, as you say, in a trust. You know, I look at the government in opposition or the potential government, you know, there's all the politicians sit there making these really wacky statements about, we cut this, we do this, and we do that. And when they get into power, they go, actually, now we've got the books open, we see the data. Actually, we know we can't now, but we can't say we didn't. That.
Yeah,
we can't tell it.
That's really difficult as well. And I think often when you look at, when you observe, think particularly the UK Parliament, I find it's not about debate. It's just about mudslinging and almost playground behaviours as well, which I think devalues the whole process. There's no structured debate. It's just who can slag the other party off with the greatest panache in the moment. You know, it's like it's point scoring, but not real points, if you see what I mean. It's not about the topic. It's about visibility. That's my perception.
This topic's called Debate Society of the past, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, and I think our media don't help either. The media, the mainstream media, social media, they like this polarization because polarization creates tribes. Tribes create revenue and advertising and clicks and discussions, and people get fired up. Because unless we have emotion attached to a thought, it doesn't happen, does it? You know, we have to, negative or positive emotions. The media knows that negative emotions are stronger than positive emotions. So it drives engagement.
This is it. And if you look at a technique, say, like transactional analysis, where you've got, you know, people that are behaving adult to adult, which is rational, listening, giving, it doesn't make for great TV. Let's be fair. It's when you've got people who are acting as like the critical parent with the finger out, or where you've got people who have been the child, I don't like this, that and the foot stamping. That's what makes for good watching. Anything in the middle ground is sensible, rational, and maybe not so appealing.
There's a couple of an author I quite enjoy reading is Rutger Bregman. He's done two books that I really found inspiring. One is Utopia for Realists, which is a great read if you've not read it.
The second one is
Humankind. Humankind is about analyzing the human being, the human psyche. He really summed up the whole idea of reality TV. And what happens is in these scenarios, you know, who wants to be, you know, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Big Brother or Love Island. What they found was these would be very benign, very controlled. If you just put a group of people in the room, they'll get on. Largely, they'll get on. They'll have a good time. They'll start forming little communes and kumbaya and sing around the campfire. As you say, not great telly. So what they have to do is they have to starve them. They have to put a grenade in there, like a rogue personality who's going to disrupt. They're going to have to create a love interest, a power base. Create a leader who has power that others don't like. Suddenly you've got this disrupted human environment that creates great telly. And then, so they have to prod the bear and the beast to make it interesting. Otherwise people will just go, we assume that people are antagonistic and aggressive towards each other, but that's manufactured by the media.
Agree. And I think in most cases, I think yes, and I think I would say that manufactured by the media, but I think in face-to-face, 100% I agree. I think the challenge comes now with social media, where people say, feel that they can say all sorts of shizzle, which is a technical term, all sorts of shizzle with under the cover of being a keyboard warrior. And they don't have to actually sit in front of somebody and say, well, I think this, that and the other, because in the real life, they wouldn't actually risk that antagonistic behavior because it could be risky for them. It's the old who's the bigger dog in the pack type scenario. You know, they might get bitten back. But on a keyboard, they can be as unpleasant as they wish.
Yeah, I mean, we're recording this on the 31st of March, 2025, which is Trans Day of Visibility. And as a trans woman myself, I'm well aware that people have opinions against trans people in the whole, not necessarily against me specifically, but against people like me. But there's no accountability to those views. And often it's born out of tropes around, oh, we're protecting women and girls, or this is unnatural. It's like there's only two sexes. It says so in my biology book or the Bible or something. And people can go unrestrained, as you say, keyboard warriors, because there's no human at the end of their keyboard.
Yeah,
it's electrons. And when people meet you face to face, they hear your story. They listen to you. It becomes powerful. But again, as I said earlier, hearing a two dimensional story doesn't necessarily create change. You've actually got to have that engagement, the why, fill my soul, fill my heart, fill my pain, fill my family, fill my wife's pain. And that's where what you're doing with stories and acting brings it out, doesn't it?
And I'm really humbled by little old me, and I mean that sincerely. Little, well, I'm not that little, but older me. It's people that can. I've written that, and I've thought, oh, it might work. Who knows? And then when we've done it, it's had such a powerful reaction and response, and how people have teams have gone on to come up with safe words that they can use around the banter. I think when I'm working with some teams, they're terrified that they won't be able to have any banter at all, you know, that it's all got to be terribly polite from now on. And of course, who doesn't like a bit of banter? We all like a bit of banter. And the line is flexible, the line's fluid. It depends who's there. It depends on how people are feeling that day. That's the big thing as well. And what else they've got going on in the background. And how well you know each other, what you know about what's inside that iceberg for that person as well. And all of those factors influence people's banter tolerance, shall we say. And I think that some of the work that we've done with those teams is around encouraging them to come up with a safe word that anybody can use, where on that day, I'm not feeling it and it stops, please. Okay. And that's it. That's full stop. The band, that's no explanation needed. Not, oh, having a bad day, are we? Or anything like that. Okay. Oh, somebody's grumpy. None of that. It just stops. And that's it. Which is quite a healthy way to manage it, I think. It's where teams manage their own behavior. If you like, they're accountable for their own behavior in that way.
Wasn't it Ramesh Ranganathan, the British comedian, that tried to come up with the safe word of mate, you know, mate with an elongated eight in the middle.
Yeah.
So when you hear your mate say something inappropriate, you just go, mate. And that's
that
a code word for too far.
Yeah, you've gone too far. Yeah. Well, this one particular organization that I've been working with, they've gone with not cool. Oh, mate, that's not cool. And then it just stops. Okay. So you could have, mate, it's not cool. But you could even just say not cool. And then that's it. Stops. So that's worked for them.
Yeah, because none of us want to be the inclusion police. None of us want people to stop talking. Yeah. I'm 60 years old. I've lived a pretty colourful life, both genders. And I'm not trying to say I'm perfect. I've got some high ground here of righteousness. I'm a human. I laugh at comedy. I call myself out sometimes, thinking, actually, no, that's not right. No, stop. Yeah. It's still funny, but no, it's not really funny.
And I think it's just, there's so, I think the more we call ourselves out, and also, I'm going to say, appropriate or gently challenge other people as well, the more human we can be about not being the police in this way, you know, the banter police or the inappropriateness police. And my husband, Jerry, who I've been married to Jerry for 36 years now. He's Scottish, and when he first came to London, he would often have people say, "Come on, Scotsman, get your hand in your pocket and buy us a drink." And that he found that really annoying, because he's probably the most generous person you'll ever meet. Except when I think when you met him, Joanne, he came to your house and he ate all of your biscuits. So he does owe you at least a couple of
biscuits.
He had the last
biscuit, didn't he? He had the last biscuit on the plate.
I know, and which I couldn't believe. I was like, if I could have said, "Mate," I would have done then, right? But this happened even recently in 2024, probably just before Christmas. He was in our local pub, and somebody who we'd never met before, who came in as a guest, you know, with somebody else that he did know, said, "Oh, let the Scotsman get the drink, get his hand in his pocket." And it's like, Jerry came home and he went, I said, "Well, what did you say to him?" And he said, "Well, I didn't say anything." I said, if you don't challenge that, people will continue to do it. So it's around how you challenge. And it's kind of like, oh, that's a bit of, you know, casual racism going on there, isn't it? Or something like that. Or, oh, I can hear a stereotype, can't I? So how you do it is the thing. And not getting on, I think, not getting on your high horse. I think in the moment, people may not go, "Oh, you're so right. I'm so sorry." You know, or, "Oh, my bad." But they might think about it afterwards. That's, and it goes, they may reflect on it afterwards and go, "Yeah, maybe that's not appropriate, really." But if we don't say anything, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah. And I think also as someone on the receiving end, I have to put a little bit of a buffer between my hearing and reaction, because I was in Asda's shopping. There are other supermarkets available, obviously. And a man came around the corner and he kind of bumped into me a little bit and said, "Sorry, mate." And I just thought, I was about to react, because I really detest the word "mate" being used to me. You wouldn't call my wife "mate," you do with me. And I thought, I didn't say anything, because I thought, hang on a minute, there are some people who call everybody "mate." It's just their default.
My husband does, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And I just thought, whatever, I'm not going to take it as some personal offense. And some people do it, you can tell some people do it deliberately.
Yeah.
But I've had ice cream salesmen give me an ice cream and say, "There you go, mate." Really? We just said that to I sent my wife to the ice cream once, Marie, who you met. And he called her love. And I said, "Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he calls you love. He calls me mate." So next time I said, "I prefer you call me love next time, if that's okay." And he went, "Oh, sorry, love." And now I go back and, you know, we have a good chat and a good bit of banter. So sometimes that friendly calling it in rather than aggressively calling it out, you win hearts and minds over, don't you? Because nobody wants to be told they're a bad person or implied they're a bad person, because they're not. They're just misguided, misunderstood, not reacting. Their bias has kicked in and suddenly they say something. And I think nobody wants to be shot down in flames for, obviously if they're repeatedly in the context or they're
maliciously,
weaponizing it.
Yeah. Mm. I think most people, if they understand, it's accepting, and they are accepting. I think having empathy for them in that moment, that you don't want them to feel really bad, but equally you don't want them to carry on with that behavior, is the way to go. So it's around, as you sort of beautifully described it, it's being quite gentle about it as well, like that.
Yeah, but I will remember the negatives. You know, we talked about negatives, emotions being stronger. But the number of times I get people bump into me and I say, "Oh, sorry, love, are you okay?" And or "Love, can I help you with your case up those stairs?" I go, "Yeah, sure, please, go for it, go."
No one does that for me, Joe, I'm telling you. So you've obviously got something going on there, yeah.
Well, I look quite helpless sometimes on the underground with laptop bags and cases and things, and sometimes people go, they take pity on me, and go, "Go on then."
And there are good people around still, you know. I think you're right about, it's that confirmation bias piece. You know, what I always use the analogy of the labels when we're talking about how we have bias about others. And one of the examples that I use quite often is about drivers and cars. And it was always, it's the car, not the driver. It's interesting when you talk about it, because it's, oh, it's Audis that cut me up. It's not the person driving the Audi. It's up flipping BMWs, right? And then, of course, now it's Teslas, but there's all sorts of reasons for that as well. But there you are. But it's got nothing, but I completely miss all the times when an Audi might flash me out at a junction, or an Audi driver might flash me out at a junction. That goes because it doesn't fit the bias that I already hold about that particular group of people. So it doesn't fit. So I don't really know.
But sometimes you play to the stereotype. I mean, I've got Mercedes at the moment. I've had BMWs in the past and Audis in the past. And I remember, I think it was when I had my 4 Series BMW, I parked it and I wasn't quite in the space. Marie said to me, you're not quite in the middle of space. I said, that's why it's a BMW. People don't expect me to park correctly anyway. So I left it there. And it was like, so I played that stereotype. Yeah. And maybe other BMW drivers cut people up and go, it's all right, it's a BMW. The indicators don't work.
Yeah, they don't have indicators on a BMW. Yeah, I've just found that out. Yeah.
So you started life as a chef.
I did.
So what was the ambition to be a chef? Was it a mission star?
Well, in those, let's rewind a little bit, because actually as a young person, I didn't have the best start. I'm going to say that. I think one of my real challenges today even is a massive imposter syndrome that sits around me, because as a youngster, I was repeatedly told, you're rubbish, you're useless, you'll never be any good at that. So that was kind of the bad side. On a good day, nothing was said. Okay, so there was no positive affirmation. I didn't really feel comfortable at school at all. And that resulted in me not really applying myself. And having been told that you're useless, then if you don't do well, it kind of reaffirms the belief system that you have. Well, what do I expect? You know, of course I'm going to leave with a handful of nothing, because everybody told me that I wasn't going to amount to anything. So, you know, that's kind of what I expected. I loved cooking. I still love cooking. So I started as a chef. And in those days, it was really rare for women to be in the kitchen. It was very male dominated. And I do remember once we had a new head chef come into the kitchen, and I was standing facing the stoves, had my back to the pass. And he came in and he went, oh, you. Get your flipping haircut, all right? So there was an assumption that everyone in the... Oh, you lad, get your flipping haircut. And that was it. So there was an assumption that everyone in there was male. I had to be tougher, harder, stronger, work longer hours, deal with a lot of really difficult banter as well in that environment. I think I loved it. I love the challenge of it. I love the frisson that you get from... You've got so many, you've got to get this out, you've got to get that done. And you're juggling a lot of things at the same time in a hugely pressurized environment. And it's got to be really well done. And I don't mean that steak had to be really well done. I mean, you know, it's got to be professionally produced. It takes an incredible toll on your social life. And I think as a youngster, I was then working 5.5 day week. And then I had Sunday afternoons and Mondays off. And Monday was my college day. So that meant that actually you don't have any time off at all, which is quite hard work, quite hard for a youngster. I made a sort of transition into working more in hotel management, but I couldn't really get that far because I didn't really have great qualifications. I then worked after I met Jerry, who became my husband, working shifts wasn't really working for me. And so I had the opportunity to work for quite a big, well-known company in the UK as a facilities manager. If you can run a hotel, you can run a couple of buildings with one hand tied behind your back, because it's not a 24-hour operation. Catering's much simpler. And although you've still got to deliver a high level of customer service and facilities, it's way easier. And all the mechanical engineering stuff and all of that, it's way easier than actually running a hotel. Much, much easier. A, you know how many people you're going to have through the door every day. You know how to staff yourself, for example. That organization then moved to a centralized site and I was going to be made redundant. And they said, well, how about a role in our training team, learning and development? And I was like, okay, then off I go. And that's when everything happened for me. It was like I had the best ever leader. And he was somebody who I find it quite hard to talk about him, because I get emotional in a really positive way. Because for the first time, he was somebody who really trusted me, who recognized that I had something a bit more than just get the coffees in, Pippa, or do this or do that. He recognized that I had potential, and he so challenged me every single time that he gave me an assignment. He'd go, right, here you are. going to drop the bomb on you here. Fine. How do you think you're going to start this one, Pip? And he'd start by, what I didn't realize was he was coaching me. And what that coaching did was it totally unlocked my potential. It got me critically thinking for myself. And it enabled me to actually realize that I could actually be successful. There was a bit of a blip. I can tell this story now because it's a lot of years down the line. There was a bit of a blip because he, on my application for that organization, I slightly exaggerated some of my school qualifications, shall we say, my leaving qualifications. And that year, that particular year, the company that I was working for, this person, my manager, recommended me to do a degree, fully sponsored degree course, which for me was terrifying because having always been a failure and you won't amount to anything, all of a sudden I've got to do this. But more urgently for me was this, I haven't actually got the A-levels that I said that I had at the time. So a bit of blagging had gone on, may I say. And I had to talk my way into a course, which actually was not as hard as you think. As a mature student, you can get in on an interview if you can prove that you're, you know,
lived experience. Yeah.
Yes. And I actually did really well. I blew myself out of the water, literally, because I applied all the skills that I'd learned on the job to how to manage the project, which is actually delivering your coursework and getting all of that done. And I was quite surprised at myself. That was probably a massive stepping stone in my confidence and becoming me. That would never have happened if it hadn't been for that one leader who saw something in me, trusted me, gave me massive exposure, but was there as a safety net and questioned me, got me to critically question how I was going to do everything. He was somebody that I really wanted to be like. And that's really why I ended up in, I think it was 2000, being head of L&D for another big household name company in the UK. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just a desk jockey now. And I'm budgeting. I'm trying to work out how I can create efficiencies. And that's not about supporting people to learn and be the best that they can be. So I jacked it, walked away. Started Poda in December 2000. Like, this is a bit scary, but huge. At that point, I had some huge belief that it would work out. And here we are 25 years later. Not global domination, but I'm really happy with where we are.
2000, I mean, the world was significantly different. You know, Tony Blair was Prime Minister, yep, doing Auld Lang Syne at the Millennium Dome.
Things will only get better and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Computing, you just think about the world, the way we're connected. I mean, I was running my IT business back in 2001. It was pre-9/11. It was pre-iPhone, pre-social media. Most people had dial-up internet still. There was no, just the whole computing revolution. There was no phone in your pocket, Google. All the things we see as, couldn't even get Deliveroo or an Uber in those days. So the world was different. It was very much more hands-on in people's offices, wasn't it? So how have you adapted what you do, I guess, to technology and expectations?
Yes, I think expectations are a movable feast, because if people trust you, and I've used the word trust a lot in this, I know, but that's because it's super important to me, then you can manage those expectations jointly so that everybody is comfortable with what's happening. I think in terms of how we changed, lockdown was an enormous catalyst for change for us. And at the beginning, I think on the day one when it all kicked off and it, right, everything's shut down, we were only a small company. And on that one day, we had cancellations. And most people took the trouble to phone us to say, we're going to have to cancel everything. We had £250,000 worth of cancellations in a day. And we were just like, okay, no, we understand. Thanks very much. And blah, 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 blah. Looking forward to working with you when we can and all that good stuff. And I think we had to learn on a vertical learning curve. So what I started to do was reach out to all of our existing clients and say, right, how can we support you to manage people remotely? Because this is the new normal for the foreseeable. And I used that to run loads of free sessions and using that as an opportunity to get my head around using some of the technology that was available. And it was, some of it was pretty sketchy right back then. You know, there was, and then there was almost like the VHS Betamax wars, for anybody that's old enough to remember that, around which platforms were going to be the ones that were adopted. And I think that was one element of change. I think people went from big multi-day programs, if you like, to wanting to see greater embedded results in the organization. So what we started to do was really more around takeaways, if you like. So people do a little learning module, they go away and apply it, and then they come back and chat about the results. And that actually has the impact of really being motivational for the rest of the cohort as well. Somebody thinks, oh, well, they've done it, so I could do it. You know, so it's really powerful stuff. I think the other thing that I did during lockdown was to support my own learning. Was I did a course with INSEAD, the Global Business School, on innovation, managing innovation during disruption. So, I mean, how much more disruption were we going through at the time? It couldn't have been a better example. And off the back of that, we came up with some virtual reality AI modules that we partnered with another organization to develop and then market, which it's interesting because I thought they would go really crazy and really take off. And people have gone, we prefer the actors, actually. So it's interesting where you offer people this great solution where they can access any time, and it which is ideal for shift workers or people who have got downtime in their day job, and then they can just do a little, oh, I'll just do that module. No, they want real people, whether that's real people through a screen or real people face to face in the room. So it was a really interesting piece of learning as well. But yes, so keeping it current, seeing what other people are doing is important. The key thing, I think, is listening and listening to what our clients need, what their aspirations are, what they want to achieve. And then it goes in here and then I go away and mulch it down. It sort of composts away in here for a bit. And then I then think about a solution. It does take a while to think about, well, how can I take this and make it into something that's really going to get people's attention. And it might be attention to challenge. It might be attention to go, aha, but how can I do that? And that does take a little bit of care. I think, oh God, how am I going to do that? And then it always comes, I have to trust the process, the composting process. So when I'm too busy, I find I don't get composting time. So that's a little bit frustrating. Yeah.
I think you're right. I'm not sure I call it composting time, but I find that I need to have those stare in space moments to sit on the sofa. Maria will come up to me and say, what are you thinking about? I said, nothing really, because I'm not really thinking about anything. I know that somewhere in my head, all my neurons are firing off, reprocessing everything, re-indexing my brain, and then things become clear. And you're right, yeah, I can go on a car journey, drive for 3 hours. I get to the end of it, I think, oh, I don't remember that journey at all, what happened. I come out and go, right, ping, 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 ping. All these ideas are firing off, where my brain has sort of used that opportunity to do that. And you can't do that while you're interacting with people, or you're stressed, or you're busy, or you're focusing.
No, you can't. You need that space. Jerry, who's my husband, who now works with our business, he's really a great implementer, transactional person, and he gets everything done. He finds it hard to understand that I need that time to just be a bit vague for a while. And that's an important part of the process as well. It's almost like in a project-based world, he would want a time code for that. You know, want a thinking time code so that he can make sure that we're making the best use of everything that we've got available to us. Yeah.
Yeah, people sometimes would equate that to procrastination, I guess, where you want to just keep playing with it. And I don't know about you, but I find that if I've got a three-week deadline, everything happens the day before. Because I'm thinking about things, I'm remodeling it and tweaking it in my mind. And when I actually go to put it on paper, it comes straight out. I don't think as I write, I've kind of got the ideation down there. And I need that evaluation time in my brain to get to that point where suddenly now I can do it.
That's real, what we would call reflective behavior. And whereas I'm much more of a, get something, think about it, get something down, and then leave it and then come back and tinker with it. So I maybe do the tinkering in a different, you're doing the tinkering up here and I'm doing the tinkering in a different way. And sometimes in organizations, there's challenges where if you've got a real activist leader and a reflector team member. Joe, that task to do 10 days ago, and she hasn't even started it yet, you know, and actually you have. It's all going on up here. It's all clicking away up here. So yeah. it can cause all sorts of conflicts as well. Yeah.
I think it serves me well sometimes where I don't have to have the world mapped out. Some people need to have their shit together, for want of a better expression. I'm quite happy to go into, I can exist in chaos because I trust my brain to be able to assemble what I need in a moment. The moment is now, make it happen. I know I can trust my brain to do that. Where some people go, well, I can't start until I can start. I've got to have this, all my ducks in a row. I've got to have this planned out. And yeah. When I get there, I've got certainty. I could turn up at an event and the organizer can say, do you mind if we change everything? And I go, okay, I'm not wedded to it. What are you thinking? And I go, okay, I can do a bit of that, a bit of this, and a bit of that.
That's born from your confidence in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's my brain works. But I've been through phases where I needed certainty, but I suppose my IT background, you never knew the result or the answer. Because people say to me, why did it take you 4 days to fix that server? And you go, well, because it was a problem. Well, I said, if it hadn't been a problem, I'd have fixed it immediately. But the problem needs investigating. You need to try different scenarios, different thought processes in order to get to the point of where I said, well, I still don't understand, but you know, a problem's a problem because it's a problem, you know, it just is. And how many things do we do every day that aren't actually problems? They just solve first time. And it's easy to say, well, if I'd done the last thing first, but then there are times I'd probably do the last thing first. You just don't realize it, or I don't realize it. And that's experience as well, going beyond a cut short circuit. And so I guess I've been used to having that analytical mind where you try different scenarios and some of those are happening in your head. And you go, no, have I tried that before? Yeah, I've done that. No, the probability of that, yeah, almost like my own GPT in my head, if you like. All the scenarios kick out. So, yeah, I guess we all think differently, but yeah, that works for me.
Yeah, I think that's another piece around supporting people to understand that actually we all approach tasks in different way. And that's equally valuable in teams, that we all approach tasks in different way. We all think in different ways. Our brains work in different ways. And what collectively we bring is what makes a team successful. And I see, and it goes back to a little bit about what I was saying earlier on about people who have got very fixed views about how people should work. It's quite often they're a very fixed and defined group of people. So they're not looking for that richness of diversity within their teams. They want everybody to think like them, be like them, look like them, because that's the right way to be.
Yeah. And also when we're delivering training, we have to recognize that as well, don't we? We have to fire the neurons in different ways for different people.
Yeah, totally. 100%. I love it. I'm still loving it now. 64 next month. Well, in fact, this coming month, very soon, it's 31st of March to April. I can't keep going forever, obviously. But what I say is, as long as I'm still relevant, I'll be continuing. I couldn't imagine retiring, really. So
I saw a keynote from Lindsay at 55 Redefined the other day. And she's talking about the ageism is the next barrier.
Yes, I read that as well.
Yeah. And when we look at the workforce, millennials will turn 50 in 6 years' time, I think.
Yeah.
So the bulk of our workforce will suddenly become over 50 because our population is shrinking. Now, women have to have 2 points, I think, children to create a sustainable population. And women are giving birth at the rate of 1.2 or something. I can't remember the exact figure she said. So basically, our population and the global population is now shrinking. So Gen Alphas and Gen Zs will be the smallest cohort for many, many, many generations. So we have to start investing in our 50s, our Gen Xs, even our boomers still, and our millennials. So we have to find a career that lasts us into our 80s because we can't afford to retire. Retirement was meant to be 5 years and then you die. It's now seen as a 40-year birthright. You know, you retire in your 60s, live to your 100. And unless we've got a mega pension, which my generation just don't have mega pensions anymore.
I think that's another reason for keeping going is the financial one. But equally, I don't feel ready. I don't feel ready to stop yet. I'm still reading things and get excited about things. And as long as I'm still getting excited, then it's got to happen, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm excited too. I think I see innovation every day. I mean, see AI coming on board. We see internet and technology and computing getting faster and phones and the attitudes of people. You think, well, there's so much more to do. And I think going back to what we talked about earlier about working from home, working from the office, I don't feel that I have to exhaust myself commuting, traveling, being a slave to someone else's culture and environment. I create my own culture. I feel very empowered to have this gig economy, this multi-career, multi-idea, entrepreneurial, make money in different directions. So I can keep my brain firing on different things and not feel I'm in this trudge. When people say, oh, well, I'm looking forward to retiring next year, I think, to do what?
I completely agree with you. And you know what? Nothing disappoints me more is when I meet people and they are moaning about their job, the organizations that they work in, and everything about it, any change that's going on, colleagues, how they're being managed. I said, well, why don't you do something else? Why don't you leave? Oh, no, I can't do that. Well, why not? Pension in 7 years. It's like, so you're going to completely burn the next 7 years of your finite resource of life doing something that for a third of your week you clearly hate. And if you clearly hate it, you're not going to be doing the best job, may I say that as well, because you might be doing an adequate job, or they might be doing an adequate job, but they're not going to be doing the best work. So how can people waste their life? That's what I don't understand.
It's like the old adage, you know, if someone says they're too busy, it means it's not a priority.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've always got time to do something you want and you enjoy
and you're
value.
Interested in.
Yeah. So that maybe if you're thinking, I need to retire from what? Which part of what you're doing do you want to retire from?
Yeah.
Do you want to retire from being engaged and passionate and creative? No, you don't. You want to be retire from being told what to do, to commuting, to being a slave, to getting up at 5 a.m. to jump on it. Yeah, great. We'll retire from that bit. But find yourself a passion and purpose. Otherwise, you'll just be floating around, having arguments at home, kicking the cat, getting bored. I've got time to go on holiday. I've got time to wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning, have a lay-in, do what I want to do, work with clients, not work on Friday afternoons. I've got time to do what I need to do. Yeah, I've also got time to really be passionate about what I do as well. So yeah, you can reprioritize.
That's exactly what I believe as well. There we are. Full alignment. Love it.
And that's the future of work, is that. That's the future of work.
Agreed.
Pippa, we've been yakking on now.
We have.
And thank you to you who are listening to this. We've been yakking on now for nearly an hour and a half because we had a good old chat and catch up before we went press the record button, as I always do. So how can people get hold of you?
Well, poda.co.uk is a good start, is our website, or pippa@poda.co.uk. You can look me up on LinkedIn, Pippa O'Brien, and or just kind of shout. I'll hear you somewhere, right? Don't worry at all. If you are listening and you think we could help you in any way, do get in touch. But more importantly, Joe, thank you for listening, really. And thanks to everybody else for listening. It's been a really interesting experience.
Pippa, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
That was great.
Thank you. That was interesting.
It says, refresh the page as the problem persists. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.